From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Scott Simon. This hour, controversies over President-elect Trump's nominations for national security jobs. Then the lives of Afghan women grow even harder under the Taliban. The week in sports, a remembrance for Ted Olson, who made legal arguments and friends across political lines. And Barry Keoghan on his new film and finding acting after a challenging childhood.
I was finding myself. I was once feeling a part of a bubble that I belonged in, and I just loved it. I loved it.
First, we have our newscast. Today is Saturday, November 16, 2024.
KAXE News, I'm Larissa Donovan with the Up North Report.
A 19-year-old man was struck and killed in Hibbing Thursday night. The State Patrol reports Dennis Anderson of Biscay was walking east near Highway 169 and East 25th Street and was struck by a northbound Ford Edge in the same intersection. The driver was identified as a 43-year-old Chisholm man. Alcohol is not believed to be a factor and roads were wet at the time of the crash. Negotiations continue between union members at Essential Health Deer River and the healthcare organization. Employees returned to work after a five-day strike last week. Megan Buffington spoke with the two sides and shares where things are at.
An eight-hour mediation session Tuesday appears to have been largely unproductive. The two sides still disagree on pay, wage scales, and contract length. Essential wants to stick with the standard three-year contract, which it says provides security for employees and patients. The union is proposing a one-year contract in anticipation of nursing home worker minimum wage standards from the Department of Labor and Industry that will begin in 2026. Kayla Schwenkel is an internal organizer for the Service Employees International Union, who represents the Deer River workers. She uses a licensed practical nurse as an example. The union is asking for $22.50 an hour. Essentia says $22.20. The state's current proposal says $27.
When we are being told that we're being unrealistic and it's not sustainable for the community, we know that we're not being outrageous.
Essentia spokesperson Kim Kaiser says they want to protect access to rural health care.
We know that healthcare in rural areas is challenged, and we are just asking the SEIU to partner with us on a realistic, sustainable contract that both upholds good local jobs and also protects access to high-quality rural healthcare.
Both sides have requested new dates for mediation.
After months of discussion about how to cut down on cell phone disruptions during class time, Brainerd School Board members agreed this week to continue using the district's current policy instead of a potential school-wide ban. The Brainerd Dispatch reports that Interim Superintendent Peter Grant feels students recognize that by following the rules, they wouldn't get the, quote, hammer. The current policy states cell phones should not be used during class time at the high school, but does not actually restrict their use. Board members learn not all teachers enforce it the same way, creating inconsistency for students. They agreed to start by cracking down on enforcement of the current policy, with plans to come back with new regulations when students come back to school after the winter break. The idea of a ban, however, was not popular among students. A survey of students earlier this year showed nearly 100% were opposed. The girls' swimming and diving state meet began Thursday, and the football state tournament continues this week. Here's Megan Buffington with a high school sports update.
Four of the six Northland divers at the state meet qualified for Saturday's finals. Preliminaries and semifinals were Thursday. The top 20 of the 32 divers continue to semifinals immediately following the prelims, and then the top 16 move on to the finals. Detroit Lakes senior Hope Hamm jumped to sixth at the end of semis. She was in eighth after prelims. Riley Duravec, a senior competing for Cloquet Esco Carlton, finished the semis in eighth after ending prelims in third. Park Rapids senior Allie Rowland is the third Northern Minnesota diver in the single A finals. She was in 13th when the semifinals concluded. Just one Northland diver made it to state in 2A. That's Bemidji senior Kennedy Olson. She was in 14th after semis. Swimmers from Grand Rapids, Hibbing, Mesabi East, Proctor Hermantown, Rock Ridge, Two Harbors, Detroit Lakes, Park Rapids, and Brainerd also qualified for the state meet and will be racing through the weekend. Five Northern Minnesota football teams made it to this week's state semifinals. Listen to the Up North report next week to learn who makes it to the Prep Bowl and how swimmers and divers placed. Or, if you want to know sooner, check out our sports roundup at kaxe.org.
That's it for the Up North report from the KEXE News Desk. I'm Larissa Donovan, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North report is made possible by Woodland Bank, serving the area since 1920 with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River. Woodland Bank believes in building community and serving local nonprofits like KAXE.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Thank you for being with us. President-elect Trump assembled his national security team in a series of rapid-fire choices this week. Several are known more for their enthusiastic support of Mr. Trump than their experience in foreign policy or intelligence. NPR's national security correspondent Greg Myrie joins us. Greg, thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Scott.
Help us put some of these selections into perspective. Tulsi Gabbard, nominated for Director of National Intelligence. She is a veteran and a former Democratic lawmaker.
Yeah, she would be responsible for overseeing all 18 intelligence agencies. And, you know, just 4 years ago, Scott, she was a congresswoman from Hawaii, ran for the Democratic presidential nomination, but then she quit the party and became this huge Trump supporter. She's never worked in the intelligence community and has taken a number of very controversial foreign policy positions. You know, just days after Russia's massive 2022 invasion of Ukraine, she took to social media and called the leaders of Russia, Ukraine, and the U.S. to, quote, embrace the spirit of aloha, respect, and love. Now, if confirmed, she'll be one of the president's top advisors on this war. And Scott, I just want to quickly mention another nominee, John Ratcliffe, to head the CIA. He served briefly as director of national intelligence in Trump's first term, but only after a big battle with Democrats who said he lacked experience. We're hearing that same criticism again.
In his first term, Donald Trump chose more traditional experience figures who are sometimes described as the adults in the room. Why the different approach now?
Yeah, Trump felt he was being undermined in his first term by security officials with the Russia investigations into the 2016 presidential election. He openly quarreled with them. You know, one really memorable moment was when Trump stood next to Vladimir Putin at a summit in Finland and said he believed the Russian leader and not the U.S. intelligence agency when Putin said he hadn't interfered in the U.S. election. You know, Trump just cycled through multiple national security officials, and he increasingly chose loyalists at the end of his first term, and that's where we're starting the second term. I asked Ian Bremmer, the global affairs analyst who runs the Eurasia Group, how he sees Trump's new national security team.
Lighter experience generally would be perceived as less capable on the national security, defense, and foreign policy space, but clearly more alignment, more loyalty personally to Trump.
Greg, what might have inspired Donald Trump's nomination of someone we have seen on our monitors here in the studio, Fox News host Pete Hegseth, for Secretary of Defense?
Well, Scott, you know, I think you've probably seen him using that perch to criticize the Pentagon brass. He says American troops are poorly served by what he calls woke generals. He says they're more concerned about diversity, gender, and cultural issues than the ability to fight wars. He's an outspoken opponent of women in many combat roles. He's aggressively defended U.S. troops convicted of war crimes, and Trump has actually responded by pardoning some of them. He's just 40 24. He was a major in the Army National Guard, served in Iraq and Afghanistan. But he's never held a senior position in national security or managed a large organization. He'd be in charge of a defense department that has about 3 million employees worldwide.
National security issues don't take a break. And President Trump, from the moment he takes the oath of office, is going to face some tough issues, including Russia's war in Ukraine. What should we expect?
Yeah, Trump on the campaign trail said he could end this war, the Russia-Ukraine war, in a day, but he hasn't said how he could do this. He could cut military assistance to Ukraine or pressure that country to make territorial concessions. Now, Ian Bremmer says Trump will take a very transactional approach, and he may get some short-term victories here. But he says Trump is unlikely to worry about the broader consequences.
The question is, what does that mean long term for America's system of alliances that it's built up over many decades that comes from mutual trust and consistent commitments that the Americans uphold over time? I mean, Trump is likely to do a lot of damage to those institutions long term.
So we've discussed Trump's more controversial picks, but we should note he has had some more experienced nominees that he's chosen that do have broad supports. They include Florida Senator Marco Rubio, chosen to be Secretary of State, and Florida Congressman Mike Waltz, tapped to be the National Security Advisor.
And NPR's Greg Myrie, thanks so much.
Sure thing, Scott.
What's it like to be a girl or a woman in Afghanistan today, 3 years after the Taliban took back control? Well, here's just one example. The Taliban's Ministry of Vice and Virtue has declared that women are not even allowed to raise their voices inside their own homes if they can be heard outside those walls. Sahar Fetrat is a researcher at Human Rights Watch who focuses on women's rights. She joins us from London. Ms. Fetrat, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me in the program.
You are in touch, I gather, with girls and women in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
What do they tell you about what it's like to live there now?
Thank you, Scott. The situation for Afghan women and girls is absolutely suffocating. That's the term that they use. I'll just tell you what are the things that Afghan women and girls lost in the past 3 years. Mm-hmm. One day before the Taliban returned to power in Afghanistan, millions of girls were in school. More than a quarter of the members of the parliament were women. Women were members of the government. They were ministers. They were judges. They were professors, helicopter pilots. Women were singers, painters. They were in media. They were conceptual artists and actors. They had access to the world outside home, even if limited, even with problems and difficulties and challenges. But since the Taliban took power, the situation seems, from what the women and girls tell us, absolutely bleak and hopeless. Mm-hmm. And they say it's a graveyard of dreams for women and girls.
A graveyard of dreams. I know in the early days of the Taliban, there were women who were out protesting.
Yeah.
Does that happen anymore, or is it too dangerous?
Afghan women have been going out to the streets and protesting the Taliban's abuses from the very beginning, because they knew, they had an experience of their mothers or their aunts that were very familiar to them. And they were not only fighting for their own rights, but the rights of every Afghan. Afghan women have been going and fighting in different ways. You know, they've been talking to media, they've been starting campaigns. But because it's getting, as you said, extremely dangerous, they have had to find ways to organize together and get together indoors, or use a social media whenever they have access to make the most out of it and send a clear message to the world outside about who the Taliban are, what they are doing to women, and what the international community or the world outside could do to show solidarity with women of Afghanistan.
What could, or in your judgment, should people outside Afghanistan do?
One thing that is, I always hear from girls and women when I talk to inside Afghanistan, they say that in no way this should be normalized. And another, you know, for governments and for with the UN, one thing that Afghan women have been campaigning for example, is the codification of gender apartheid as a crime against humanity.
Let me follow up and ask you a question. When you talk about how the international community shouldn't normalize the Taliban, the international community also has an obligation to try and get humanitarian aid into Afghanistan, doesn't it?
Yes.
Isn't it difficult to decry the Taliban as criminals and then expect them to cooperate in bringing international aid into the country?
The discussion of whether we talk about rights or, you know, human rights or, you know, humanitarian aid, I don't think they are mutually exclusive. The international community, in one way or another, are already engaged with the Taliban. The issue is about how they can keep the engagement or have the engagements that they already have in a principled way, in a way that is not undermining human rights.
Yeah. President Trump's administration in his first term negotiated directly with the Taliban and excluded what was in the Afghan government. But of course, their withdrawal of U.S. forces was under President Biden. Does the Taliban care who's in the White House?
It's hard to know what the Taliban want.
Well, do you hear from anyone in Afghanistan as to what they might think about that?
With Trump being in power or in the White House, impacts Afghanistan. Aid or any other issue related to Afghanistan or human rights issues related to Afghanistan would be discussed. For example, when it comes to accountability mechanism or for asking for UN for an accountability mechanism that is not only forward-looking, that looks at the past and present abuses, we can assume that we will not have those kind of support with Trump being in the White House. But, you know, people that I am talking to are so much busy with the day-to-day struggles of life that at this point, they are really feel harmed by American, like the U.S. foreign policy that, you know, to a normal person wouldn't matter so much who is in the White House because they feel betrayed, you know, either way.
Yeah. Sahar Fitrat, researcher at Human Rights Watch, speaking to us today from London. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Listening to NPR News.
18 minutes after 8 o'clock. Good morning. Thank you for listening to KAXC and Weekend Edition from National Public Radio. At 9 o'clock, Stay Human, hosted by Michael Goldberg. This week, Tales from the Deer Stand. And at 10 o'clock, Jerry Bredeman, your volunteer host for Back Porch Harmony. Coming up at 3 o'clock this afternoon, a special on Quincy Jones. 5 o'clock, Dave Peterson, your host for Americana on America Avenue. And at 7, Green Cheese Trivia, Justine Jacobson and myself will be your hosts. I'm Jennifer Barr. We receive support from Bemidji Brewing, offering opportunities in the taproom all season long for holiday shopping and gathering. Find out more about pop-up shops, rentals, events, and more on Facebook. Bemidji Beer, nice catch. A mix of clouds and sun today, highs in the upper 40s to low 50s, winds from the southeast 10 to 15, gusting higher. Slight chance of rain before midnight, lows tonight near 38, and tomorrow mostly cloudy, highs 42 to 45, breezy west winds.
I'm Windsor Johnston with these headlines. Incoming Senate Majority Leader John Thune says all options are on the table to get President-elect Trump's cabinet picks through the chamber in the next Congress. Trump has nominated more than 24 people to serve in his next administration. Hundreds of hospitality workers in Las Vegas remain off the job after contract negotiations broke down on Friday. Workers at Virgin Hotels are demanding a new 5-year contract with higher wages and better benefits. A massive fire ripped through an intensive care unit in northern India on Friday, killing 10 newborns and injuring 16 others. Officials say the blaze spread quickly through the hospital. An investigation is underway. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Insperity, providing HR services and technology from payroll, benefits, and HR compliance to talent development. Learn more at Insperity.com/HR Matters. From Made in Cookware, Made in Cookware is crafted by chefs for use in restaurants and home kitchens around the world. Their cookware can be found at madeincookware.com. And from the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. The annual United Nations climate meeting called COP29 is about at its halfway point in Baku, Azerbaijan. Negotiators are working out details for how wealthy countries will help developing nations in a warming world. Jeff Brady from NPR's Climate Desk joins us. Jeff, thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Scott.
What have negotiators accomplished so far this week?
You know, from outside, it doesn't look like much. There's a lot of technical work going on behind the scenes right now to get to a financial agreement in the next week. But some of the most compelling moments have been speeches from leaders of developing nations. Here's the Bahamas Prime Minister Philip Davis reminding that global warming is everyone's problem.
The fires that devour your forests, the hurricanes that shatter our homes, are not distant misfortunes, but shared tragedies. What we endure, you endure. What we lose, you lose. And if we fail to act, it will be our children and grandchildren who bear the burden.
And that underscores the goal of these negotiations, which is getting wealthier countries to commit many billions of dollars to help developing nations. These are countries like the Bahamas that did little to cause global warming, you know, burning fossil fuels, but they're suffering the consequences.
Countries signed the Paris Climate Agreement almost a decade ago that aims to limit how warm the planet will get. How's the world doing so far?
The Paris goal is to limit warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius, that's 2.7 Fahrenheit, over pre-industrial temperatures. And scientists tell us that's what's needed to avoid some really bad climate effects. We're already experiencing some of them, more severe storms, you know, flooding, extreme heat. Wealthy countries agreed to cut greenhouse gases first, but the world is not on track to meet that Paris Agreement goal and will likely push past that goal. The U.S., for example, is supposed to cut climate pollution in half by 2030. We're on track for about 40% now. But, you know, scientists say every little bit of warming we avoid will make a big difference in the future.
Jeff, do countries face any penalties if they don't meet those commitments? And if not, what are these COP meetings trying to do?
There aren't penalties. This process is more about countries agreeing to do things and then holding each other accountable. For example, at last year's UN climate meeting in Dubai, countries pledged to triple renewable energy by the end of this decade. This year, the International Renewable Energy Agency came back with a report showing countries are not on track to meet that pledge. So now there's pressure for countries to step up construction of things like wind power and hydropower and geothermal energy.
And, of course, America just elected a president, now president-elect, who's called climate change a hoax. Donald Trump says he'll pull the U.S. out of the Paris Agreement again. How does that affect the talks in Baku?
You know, it's part of the discussion, but not as big a topic as I expected. One reason is that it takes a year to withdraw from that agreement. So the U.S. is expected to be back at COP in Brazil next year. There's talk about who will step up, you know, to fill the U.S. leadership gap in the meantime. Maybe China, maybe the European Union. But there are some unknowns here. The CEO of ExxonMobil, he recently asked Trump not to pull out of the Paris Agreement. He says business needs certainty, and we're going to see what President-elect Trump decides there. Meantime, at the UN climate meeting, there's still some optimism. There will be some sort of finance agreement announced in the next week or so.
Jeff Brady from NPR's Climate Desk, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And now it's time for sports. Chiefs and Bills, get set. The Cleveland Cavaliers, perfect so far, and a new era in men's tennis. Howard Bryant of Better Luck Media joins us. Howard, thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning, Scott Simon. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. let's begin with football. Kansas City Chiefs are 9-0. favored for the Super Bowl, but big test tomorrow. They will be in Buffalo to face Josh Allen and the Buffalo Bills. Could this be a playoff preview?
Well, it not only could it be, it should be between Buffalo and Baltimore, which has already lost to the Chiefs. These are the teams that are supposed to be challenging them. And the Chiefs are trying to do the thing we've never seen in the Super Bowl era, which is a team to win three straight championships. They're not that good this year, except that they're really, really good. I mean, they're they're undefeated. Yeah. They win at the last second. They win all the games.
That's exciting.
Every game is really, really close. Every game they look like they're gonna lose. They seem to sort of be mediocre, except they've got a really, really good defense. They've only given up 161 points, but they win last week on the last second blocked field goal. They just find ways to win, and they've got Patrick Mahomes. But if we're really looking at them, they're not a dominant team. They're not. You know, it's not like the 07 Patriots or the 85 Bears or the 49ers or where they just come out and crush everybody. Yeah. This team is teetering, and yet they just keep winning. That's what happens when you've got the best quarterback.
Any players or storyline surprise you now that we've passed the halfway mark?
In the league or
with
the Chiefs?
Well, both. But I mean, in the league, I'm thinking.
Well, I think in the league, obviously, Lamar Jackson's such a great player. I mean, he's just done everything that you could ask a player to do. And, obviously, with him, you're just waiting for the playoffs to see what he does. Pittsburgh has been a great story. Nobody thought that Russell Wilson was going to come back, and he was buried in Denver last year, and he was on the bench this year. And now he's the leader of a first-place team. There's a lot of good stories. And I think that, obviously, Saquon Barkley and Philadelphia, Philadelphia always pessimistic, and yet here they are, another good team. And don't forget the Washington Commanders as well. Good team, good story, new ownership, really exciting stuff over there too.
Let's move on to basketball, because there is no hotter team in pro sports right now than the Cleveland Cavaliers. 14-0, a perfect start after they won last night over the Chicago Bulls. Cleveland rocks!
I was waiting for that. I was about to admonish you. If a 14-0 Cleveland team doesn't get a Cleveland rocks, it's got to be retired.
Absolutely. No, how are they doing?
Really great team. Well, they come out. They were injured last year. They go down in the playoffs to the Knicks, and all their guys are sitting in street clothes, and here they are now. They were a good team last year, and now they're beating teams by 12.5 points. They play the world champion, defending champion Boston Celtics next week. That's going to be a great matchup. But you've got Donovan Mitchell, Jared Allen, they're really good players, and I just don't think anybody is taking them that seriously yet. But they put 144 points on Chicago last night, so time to pay attention to the Cleveland Cavaliers. Haven't seen this Cleveland team this good since LeBron James left.
Yep. Well, my Cavs jacket, I still wear it, people will be saluting this year. Finally, tennis. Look, ATP Tour Finals taking place in Italy. End of the tennis season. Only the top eight men single players are invited. Nobody named Federer, Nadal, Djokovic. End of one era, start of a new one?
Absolutely. End of an era. And it's time. I mean, it's... You know, a tear is shed, of course, because Rafa Nadal is retiring at the end of this year. He's going to play Davis Cup, and then that is the end of the great Nadal's career. Novak Djokovic, still, probably the best player when he's right, maybe, but it's a new era now. Federer, the big three, it's done. Federer, Nadal, Djokovic, all done. Novak is the only one still active. But this is the time now of Jannik Sinner and Taylor Fritz and Daniil Medvedev and, of course, Carlos Alcaraz. And at the ATP Finals right now, what are we looking at? Maybe, Sinner hasn't lost a match. It's time to get used to some new names, Scott Simon.
All right. With your help, I'll do that. Howard Bryant of Meadowlark Media, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
There was a brief flicker of amity this week when Republicans and Democrats came together to salute
Ted Olson, the former Solicitor General of the United States, who died at the age of 84. Ted Olson was considered a lion by the Conservative Federalist Society. He represented the George W. Bush campaign in the 2000 case before the Supreme Court that resulted in George Bush winning the presidency. As the administration's Solicitor General, he defended many anti-terrorism policies, even as he warned they might be overturned one day. His wife, Barbara Olson, had died in the 9/11 attacks on a plane that crashed into the Pentagon. Later in his career, Ted Olson became an outspoken conservative voice for marriage equality. Cass Sunstein joins us now. He's the Robert Walmsley University Professor at Harvard and lauded Ted Olson on X this week as the model of integrity and kindness and decency. Cass Sunstein, thanks so much for being with us.
All thanks to you.
You worked for Ted Olson earlier in your career. What was he like?
He was fun. He was full of energy. He was in love with the law. He was in love with Ronald Reagan. He was in love with intellectual integrity. If the law allowed the president to do something, he would say that. If the law didn't allow the president to do something, he would say that. And he would do both with confidence and a certain amount of zest.
How do you understand his view of the law?
Well, he was a constitutionalist in the best sense. He believed that broad authority for the president of the United States was the correct understanding of Article 2 of the Constitution, and thought that rights, broadly speaking, freedom of speech, freedom of action, that those things were embedded in the Constitution as well. And if that meant that property rights were robust, he would go there with enthusiasm. And if that meant that people got to marry those whom they loved, he would go there also with enthusiasm.
He was on our show in 2009, along with David Boies. They had been obviously adversaries in the Bush versus Gore case in 2000. They came together on our show and in court to argue in favor of overturning the California referendum against same-sex marriage. This is what Ted Olson said at that time.
Marriage is a conservative value. Of course, it's a liberal value, too. I'm not taking sides when I say that. But for people who love one another and want to be in a stable, committed relationship, that's a good thing for the community. That's a good thing for the body politic. It's good for the economy. And I think more and more people who are conservative are recognizing there are gay people. There always will be gay people. And we want them to participate equally in the rights that we have. That is good for all of us.
What do we hear in that section of Ted Olson's character?
There are two things, I think. One is his conservatism. So marriage is a time-honored institution. And for Ted, who lost his wife under tragic circumstances and found love again, this is something that was sacred to him, I think. And the second is an idea about liberty. And if two people love each other and want to get married, he thought that's part of their freedom.
Cass Sunstein, what might people on all sides of a question learn from Ted Olson's life and work today?
I think two things. One is laughter, that is a great connector. Also, respectful engagement. Ted, of course, would disagree often with the left, most often with the left, and sometimes with the right. I had a bunch of disagreements with him when I was a young lawyer working for him, and also over the years. And when we disagreed, he would always have a sense that, you know, while he was right, he thought, the other person deserved respect. And there was some chance the other person was also right or had at least some truth on their side. And that form of respectful engagement can often lead to productive interactions and friendship across difference.
Harvard's Cass Sunstein speaking of his friend Ted Olson. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. An honor and a pleasure.
Weekend Edition is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. Like a story you heard on this or another NPR program? Share it with a friend at npr.org. While there, you can also hear stories you missed, enjoy expanded content, or connect to your favorite member station.
And you're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. The Kansas City Chiefs are having a great year, but they're not the only successful football team in town. Kansas City's other Chiefs, a wheelchair football team, is also undefeated, 9-0, and this team is also built around an outstanding quarterback. Frank Morris of member station KCUR reports.
Football is fast and rough. Wheelchair football, same. At a weeknight practice in a small-town high school gym, muscular guys strapped down tight to compact wheelchairs are whirling, darting, and smashing into each other. Think hockey with tighter turns.
It's high impact, high intensity. It's a very fast game. There's a lot of collisions and going on the ground, but at the same time, it's very poetic.
Matt Bolick, the Chiefs' star quarterback, can sling the ball 40 yards from his chair accurately under pressure. He played college football before a weightlifting injury cost him the use of his legs. Rookie defensive lineman Dante Hill comes at the game differently. With a lifelong disability, he's new to football and loving it.
Sometimes if you blitz, you might hit the gap just right and you have a clear lane to the running back or quarterback and you just get to ram right into him.
Those collisions can topple players. Some players use explosive acrobatic moves to spring themselves upright. Bruises, scrapes, and broken bones are all part of the game. Wheelchair football players square off 7-on-7. Their field stretches 60 yards, except it's not a field. It's generally concrete, asphalt. 13 of the 14 teams competing in the USA Wheelchair Football League are named after the NFL teams in their cities. Players wear the helmets and jerseys of their home teams, which pumps up Bolick.
Yes, it's a pride thing. It's hometown. It's a logo. It's a symbol, and it's kind of life for me. I grew up watching the Chiefs, and I've always wanted to be a part of this team, and now I have an opportunity. Hopefully, I can make the best of it.
The organization Move United founded the league 6 years ago with help from the Bob Woodruff Foundation and the NFL. Glenn Mary is Move United's executive director.
And I think it's really important to recognize that it's different. We had to adapt the game. But if you're watching this game, you're going to understand these people are athletes and that they're people.
Adapting to the game takes money. Those fast, sturdy wheelchairs start around $3,000. Travel for games, funding to put on tournaments, it all flows through the NFL's Salute to Service program. Half the players are veterans, like Chiefs offensive lineman John Teagarden, still in the game at 61.
I try to keep up with them. They keep getting younger, they keep getting stronger, they keep getting faster. It's not me that's changing, it's them.
The young league is changing too, drawing 30% more participants this year than last and looking for expansion teams. Meanwhile, the Chiefs are looking for their second national championship.
We call it the Super Bowl, but it's not the Super Bowl. It's the national championship, but pretty much all of us call it our Super Bowl.
Chiefs defensive back Jason Loftus says competing itself is a win.
You know, I mean, it's because some of us, our legs don't work or we're missing part of them. Doesn't mean we can't compete and go out there and win games.
The wheelchair Chiefs are building a legacy. They've won a berth in every one of the league's 4 championship games, and they like their chances at home next Saturday against the Chicago Bears. For NPR News, I'm Frank Morris in Kansas City.
This is NPR News.
It is 8:39. You're listening to KAXE and Weekend Edition. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 9 o'clock, Stay Human, hosted by Michael Goldberg. This week's stories from the deer stand. Terry O'Brien tells the tale of one old doe. Scott Stoll contemplates the red squirrels. And Matthew Miltich explains what happens when worlds collide. Stories from other friends and neighbors, too, with great music. Every week on Stay Human, Saturdays 9 a.m., Sundays at 5 p.m. We receive support from the Blandin Foundation Strengthening Rural Minnesota. More at blandinfoundation.org. We also thank Dale's Auto Body, serving the auto body needs of Grand Rapids and surrounding communities since 1984. Performing auto body and collision repair as well as auto glass replacement, dedicated to getting you back on the road after an accident. More online at dalesautobodyinc.com. A mix of clouds and sun today, highs in the upper 40s to low 50s, southeast winds 10 to 15, gusting higher. Mostly cloudy tomorrow, highs 42 to 45.
Windsor Johnston with these headlines. President Biden is meeting with Chinese President Xi Jinping today on the sidelines of a global summit in Peru. The trip likely marks Biden's final interactions with world leaders as he prepares to leave office. The daughters of civil rights leader Malcolm X are accusing several law enforcement agencies of playing roles in his assassination in 1965. They filed a $100 million lawsuit in Manhattan on Friday against the CIA, FBI, and New York Police Department. YouTuber turned boxer Jake Paul beat former heavyweight champion Mike Tyson in a highly anticipated matchup last night. It was a unanimous decision in the 8-round bout. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Indiana University, committed to moving the world forward and working to tackle some of society's biggest challenges. 9 campuses, one purpose, creating tomorrow today. More at iu.edu. And from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose mission is to assess practitioner competency to create design solutions that safeguard public health, safety, and welfare. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. This is NPR.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. A warning, the next story is about sexual assault. It will last about 7 minutes. 80 years ago, U.S. and Allied soldiers stormed the beaches of Normandy to begin the liberation of Europe from the Nazis. But that liberation came at a painful price for one French family that is only now coming to terms with what happened in the summer of 1944. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley brings us the story.
No. Ah, yes. Attends.
66-year-old Michel Salin walks across a field to a farmhouse in Brittany. After D-Day, American soldiers fanned out across this western region of France and neighboring Normandy.
This is a place, the farm, where my grandfather has been killed and my mother raped. August 1944, at the end of the war, with an American soldier.
She says an American soldier shot her grandfather, Eugène Tournelec, as he was trying to protect his 17-year-old daughter, Catherine, her mother. Her grandfather left behind a widow and 6 children. Her mother was left with an emotional wound that never healed.
This was a secret for us, all the family. My 3 sisters and my 2 brothers, nobody knew this.
Sexual violence committed by American GIs in the wake of D-Day has long been a taboo subject, partly because of the huge place the Normandy invasion holds in America's collective imagination, says Mary Louise Roberts. This professor emerita at the University of Wisconsin-Madison is one of the few historians who's consulted both American and French archives.
Towards the end of the summer of 1944, there really was a problem with rape. And the United States Army, at the highest levels of SHAEF, were concerned about it.
SHAEF was the Supreme Headquarters Allied Expeditionary Force, commanded by General Dwight D. Eisenhower. Roberts says in some ways the problems were created by the Army. To motivate soldiers, it portrayed French women as highly sexualized.
U.S. soldiers saw themselves as knights in shining armor, awaiting the open arms of French women.
One French newspaper in Cherbourg reported rapes and murders instilling fear in families across the countryside in late summer 1944. Roberts says the U.S. command knew it had to do something to show that the occupying power was disciplined and trustworthy, so using the racist assumptions prevalent at the time, they singled out black soldiers.
They could blame African Americans based on the belief that they were hypersexual and violent, and thus exonerate white American soldiers from accusations of rape.
Quick military trials were set up. Of the 152 American soldiers tried for rape, 139 were black, even though blacks made up just 10% of the fighting force. Nearly all of the soldiers publicly executed in France by hanging, 24 out of 29, were black. Behind a graveyard in Brittany, Michel Salin and her sisters are at the spot where 34-year-old Private William Mack, a black soldier from South Carolina, was hanged for the murder of their grandfather in February 1945. Nobody in town asked for this execution, says Sister Jean Plassard. It was the liberation. Everyone was happy. This was just our family's pain.
Bonjour.
We go into the nearby house of Brother Jean-Pierre Salin and look at old photos. The siblings say the crime, and especially the silence around it, poisoned their mother's life and cast a shadow over their family. But they don't blame the Americans. They blame a rigid, religious French society. Why did we have to keep silent about the rape of our mother and the murder of our grandfather to live in peace, asked Jean-Pierre Salin. Such was the shame, he only learned his grandfather's first name when he was 15 and had to ask. No one spoke about him because that would have meant asking about what happened to their mother, he says. She cried at night, says youngest sister Marie-Annick Gouez. I thought it was something we kids did to hurt her. This is what galls Jean-Pierre the most, he says, taking out a book about their tiny town during the Second World War. There's not a word in here about our grandfather, he says. They even talk about how many horses were killed, but not a word about our grandfather. Marie-Annick says D-Day anniversaries are always hard.
Qu'est-ce qu'on va dire, nous?
What can we say, she says. They saved France and the world. Our pain was just a drop in the bucket. What's tragic is that women are still paying the price in war. The siblings say what saved their mother was her voice. She sang at local festivals. It let her fit in when villagers shunned her, something they didn't understand as children.
Kusk, kusk.
In 2013, when she was on her deathbed, Catherine Tournelec-Salin told her grown-up children about the rape, one by one, though by then they knew. They say finally talking together about what happened has been liberating.
Notre grand-père ne sera jamais...
This year, on the 80th anniversary of the rape and the murder, the family gathered at the grave of their grandfather. It was the first time they had come together to honor him and their mother. The mayor was there, along with two French veterans holding flags.
Notre grand-père n'est pas mort pour la France.
Reading from a paper and choking back tears, Jean-Pierre Salin said their grandfather may not have died for France under enemy bullets. His field of honor was his home, he said, where he tried to protect his children. Grandpa, we came to tell you we are proud of you. You may not be a hero of France, but you are our hero. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Brittany, France.
The term Renaissance man emerged before Leonardo da Vinci was even born in the 15th century, but the Florentine artist, scientist, and engineer came to embody its spirit. The label has stuck, says the documentary filmmaker Sarah Burns.
He does not see boundaries between these disciplines that today we would say art is over here and science is over here. It's all part of this grand experiment.
Now, Da Vinci's subject of a PBS miniseries by Sarah Burns, her father Ken Burns, and David McMahon. You can hear more later today on All Things Considered from NPR News. Listen on your smartphone, smart speaker, or just tune in on your very smart and clever local member station. Andre Arnold's new movie, Bird, draws on familiar themes from the director's work. The young outsiders of American Honey, the aspirations of a teen girl in Fish Tank, the focus on the natural world in her documentary about a dairy cow. Bird follows a young teen girl named Bailey, growing up in a low-income housing estate in England in a fractured family.
The setting is urban, but the wonders and mysteries of nature play a key role. So does the Irish actor Barry Keoghan, who plays Bailey's father, known as Bug. Of course, Barry Keoghan was nominated for an Oscar for The Banshees of Inisherin and appeared memorably in the film Saltburn and on the red carpet at the Met Gala. Barry Keoghan joins us now. Thanks so much for being with us.
That's a lovely introduction, by the way.
Well, thank you. I will tell the person who authored it. Tell us about Bug.
Bug is someone who is figuring himself out and not understanding that he has certain responsibilities in life other than his own.
Well, he's got a couple of children, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does. And, you know, just like every father and that, it's safe to say that we've all been selfish and not sometimes prioritize what's mostly important. This character really shines a light on that, not to cushion it or to sugarcoat it. It's a lot more relatable to me, and it just kind of gave me a chance to sit in that world and reach for stuff that was relatable and be honest and vulnerable, and all while being protected by Andrea Arnold.
Yeah. Can I get you to talk about how you grew up? Because you bounced around, I gather, from family to family.
Yeah, I did. I grew up in a foster care away, and me and my younger brother, and then we're taken to full-time care by my granny and given a good home and looked after very much. But yeah, we had our journey together, me and my brother, and yeah.
And your mother had a rough time in life, right?
She did, God bless her. She was quite young as well, and my father was quite young, and they had their troubles, you know, and me being a father now, you understand the responsibilities and you understand the weight that everything carries and, you know, how to navigate through it all. And I understand it. And whereas when I was younger, I didn't. You just got to take these things on board and help, you know, break that cycle and create a better one for your little one.
I want to play a scene early on in the film, if we could. Mm-hmm. It's between you and Bailey, played by Nakia Adams. And you're kind of upbraiding her, if you please, for cutting her hair short just before you're going to marry your girlfriend. Let's listen.
What the f*** are you doing with your hair, man?
I cut it.
Did you do it on purpose?
Yeah.
Ah, you got to ask me when you do stuff like this. You can't do this.
In what way? I've got to do.
You have to ask me. I'm your father, darling.
You didn't ask me about getting married?
Because I'm an adult. You're 12.
So what?
What goes through you in a scene when you have to play the father-child scene like that?
I think he realizes in that moment that he's like, you know, I don't think he believes his position or, you know, that he's a father. This is a moment of him being challenged and him taking the easy card and going, I'm your father. You know, it's like, you can't really just say that. You have to behave like that and you have to show that in leadership and, you know. But again, in this scene, we see it's about him and his massive day. You know, no consideration for his daughter going through adolescence and going through all these tough things that she's facing. It's just about him.
Do I have this right? You turned down Gladiator 2 to make this film with Andrea Arnold?
There were scheduling difficulties, yeah. It was such a shame I couldn't do 2. But that always happens. But there's reasons why I do certain movies and if I'm going to learn from things and what a character says for me. And I felt I was at a place at that time where Bird and Bug made more sense to do. I've always looked to work with Andrea Arnold as well.
And why?
Because she dives into the core of a human, I feel, especially with every movie. Like, you see certain performances, that's, you can't teach that. That there is a trust and a level of someone allowing someone into, and well, being invasive, allowing someone in to shine a light or to show raw feelings. And I knew she'd do that with me, and she'd make me search and discover in the moment. And she is one of, if not the best, filmmakers, and we all know that. But also, she's an extraordinary human, and I have massive respect for her, and she's helped me a lot.
I'm not clear on how you became an actor.
I'm not clear on that bit either. That could be one of those things that it just fell into my hands, but it really did. I was searching for something that was allowing me to express. And where I come from, there's all sources to do that. Some right, some wrong. Some illegal, some not. This is one where I allowed my imagination to come in. And then, you know, after everything, I was like, oh, you also get paid for this. You know, that was the last thing. I was finding myself. I was once feeling a part of a bubble that I belonged in. And I just loved it. I loved it.
Let me try some amateur psychology.
Go on.
If you bounce between 13 different sets of foster parents,
mm-hmm.
you're going to do some acting.
Yeah, I like that. You know, when you get perspective on it all, there's a sense of, who am I? Do you know, if these people aren't accepting me, you know, that's embedded into me that no one is accepted. Now I know they were foster homes and it's a temporary thing, but rejection is in there and, you know, and your trust comes in being like, why aren't people accepting me for who I am? You know, so that carries on into life and you trying to play different characters to see what fits or what doesn't fit. And I think that's where it really comes from. It's one of the best questions that someone's just pointed out or said to me.
You dance and sing quite memorably in this film.
I do. Triple threat, me, actor, dancer, singer, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, you had a scene in Saltburn. Let me put it this way, just you and the camera.
That's it. There you go.
Well, this is a little different, but in any event, you sing a song by the band Blur.
Mm-hmm.
Which means a lot after what we've seen in the film.
Yeah, I mean, each song, you know, even Lucky Man, it's my favorite song ever. I told Andrea that. I think singing is such a representative of someone that's really beyond speaking. I think it's a very honest movie and very close to the skin. We all know a bug. We all have a brother or a father that has them traits, and it's innocence at the end of the day.
Barry Keoghan, his new movie in theaters now, Bird. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much. That was a lovely interview. But I'm a lucky man with fire in my hands.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Smiling, I feel no disgrace with who I am.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance, working to help protect small businesses and the owners that run them, offering customizable coverages to salons, accounting firms, tradespeople, and more. Learn more at progressivecommercial.com. From the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. And from ECMC Foundation at ECMCFoundation.org.
It is just before 9 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Find more at KAXE.org. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up next, Stay Human, hosted by Michael Goldberg. And at 10 o'clock, Back Porch Harmony. Your volunteer host today is Jerry Bredeman. Mostly cloudy to partly sunny today, highs in the upper 40s to low 50s, winds from the southeast 10 to 15, gusting higher, slight chance of rain before midnight, and overnight lows near 38. For tomorrow, mostly cloudy, highs 42 to 45, breezy west winds 10 to 25, and looking ahead to Monday, mostly sunny with highs in the upper 40s. If you would like a Thanksgiving meal delivered to you in the Bemidji area, you may put in your request by Monday, November 25th at noon. There are also opportunities for volunteering and monetary donations are welcome. Text us for more information, 218-326-1234. There are meetups for those new to the Iron Range the third Tuesday of every month at the Hibbing Public Library and the third Thursday at the Virginia Public Library. Meetings are from 4:30 to 6 at both locations. RSVP at helloironrange.com.